There is this thing. Do you realize
what is there is this thing?
Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing
on.
There is this thing going on.
What
do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Hi, welcome back to Unfit to Print. This is CKUT on 90.3 FM, broadcasting not live, but still from Montreal. My name is Amy Lloyd.
And I'm Maya Ibbetson.
Today we broadcast from the Jiajiage, the traditional territory of the Haudenosaunee and the Anishinaabe Nations.
Today we have our last episode of Unfit to Print for the year, and Amy and I's last episode of Unfit ever. We are so grateful to have produced and recorded this show over the past 2 years, even when we shifted to remote production. We'll touch on that more later, but for today's feature, we're covering the uptick in domestic violence incidents since COVID-19 began as a pandemic in North America. This comes in the wake of 7 horrific reported femicides in the past 7 weeks in Quebec. We want to talk about intimate partner violence, why it's going unreported, why the pandemic has further compromised survivor safety, and how you can recognize and help survivors in need. We're going to issue a content warning as this segment discusses domestic abuse and death. Prior to that, we've got a few headlines and a few tunes as per usual. Don't go anywhere, we'll be right back.
Cup, tell me what the fuck's for lunch. Is it your pussy or dinner? Both seem like the same to us. Dracula to your neck. I was trying to leave stress. You look yummy in that dress. I expect nothing less. Chain keys swinging in your mouth. Not a chain stain with some cherry lip gloss. Tequila your tears so we move from state to state. Sipping on your stars as I fuck you by the lake. Look, turn around and bust it back. One time. Give you this dick and you relapse. 2 times. Waking up the clothes all over your apartment. Pearls on your neck, sobbing young on the carpet. Road trips to Nice, but we ain't going up to Greece. Maybe I'm the one you call Amina in the sheets. A lot of text messages that I wanna delete. But to get over this day we in, I just copy Celine.
Don't leave me here. Drink up the tears and cry. Drink up the tears. She'll take you home, tie you up and slap you without even asking. And all the clamps and whips in Los Angeles couldn't faze her. So if you really want to see her in pain, just wait until later.
That was Hope Tala with Cherries featuring Aminai, followed by TV Girl with Safe Word. Now for our weekly headline roundup. Samer, a 33-year-old Jordanian man who is only identified by his first name, attempted to seek asylum in Montreal on the grounds that he identifies as bisexual, according to CTV News. Yesterday, he was set to be deported at the hands of his own father. In a letter filed by his lawyer to the Immigration and Refugee Board, Samer's relatives note how he has, quote, shamed the family, unquote, and his relatives also detail how he will be killed if he returns to Jordan. Samer's incident is not the first of its kind. Past asylum hearings for LGBTQIA plus individuals from Jordan show that the Jordanian government and authorities won't intervene in possible threats of death. In spring 2019, Samer walked the illegitimate border between New York State and Canada at Roxham Road that has acted as a passageway for thousands attempting to seek asylum in the country. When he was 18, Samer was involved in a car crash in Ohio, which killed his best friend. He was convicted of vehicular homicide and sentenced to 2 years in prison. Samer crossed the border to Canada after being hate crimed for his race in the U.S. Under Canadian law, however, Samer's jail sentencing means he is illegitimate to seek asylum in Canada. Samer is what policymakers are calling Donald Trump refugees, in the sense where he just showed up to the border and sought asylum status. Recent violence for such refugees is occurring at the Roxham Road border as more individuals come to Canada to seek asylum from the U.S. However, Samer is unable to return to the U.S. and is unable to stay in Canada, so he's therefore sentenced to return to Jordan. A Montreal-based LGBTQIA plus group called AGIR spoke to CTV and said that they are working on Samer's case. A spokesperson from AGIR noted that, quote, they're basically sending a man to his death. In Jordan, there might not be a law against homosexuality, but the theory versus the reality is very different, unquote. Another spokesperson from AGIR speaking about Samer's case said that, quote, officially, Jordan does not criminalize homosexuality, but the reality on the ground is much different. Honor killings do happen, murders happen, the repercussions for such crimes are minor, unquote. If you want to know more, you can visit the AGIR website. This organization is doing incredible work for LGBTQIA plus migrants in Montreal.
Now it is time for our weekly COVID update. This is as recent as Monday for reference. To quote the Montreal Gazette, COVID-19 deaths are leveling off, but hospitalizations and severe cases are rising, says Dr. Teresa Tam, Canada's chief public health officer. She says, quote, this rise in severe and critical illnesses is placing renewed strain on the healthcare system and healthcare workforce. Provincial and territorial data indicate that an average of 2,394 people with COVID-19 were being treated in Canadian hospitals each day during the most recent seven-day period, which was March 26 to April 1st, including 700 of whom were being treated in intensive care units. During the same period, there were an average of 30 COVID-19-related deaths reported daily. While this lagging severity indicator has leveled off, there is a concern that the trend could also shift if the increase in severe illness trends persist. Tam goes on to say that the infection rates are highest amongst those 20 to 39. Although severe illness is less common among adults, it is important to remember that serious illness can occur at any age. Evidence indicates that the variants of concern can be associated with more severe illnesses and increased risk of death. In addition, circulation of COVID-19 in younger, more mobile, and socially connected adults presents an ongoing risk for spread into high-risk populations and settings. The emergence of this, the emergence and spread of certain SARS-CoV viruses variants heighten this concern, unquote. All right, so as we mentioned earlier, we wanted to sort of secure this time as like a goodbye, a send-off, so people may be very confused, but Maya and I are no longer going to be on Unfit. Instead, the third voice that you've been hearing in a lot of our audio essays, Pilar Steers, is going to be taking over my position as radio editor and replacing Maya's position as co-host with whoever lucky person is of her choosing. Maya?
Yeah, I think that this time had to come at some point. I think that we've done 2 years on radio, and it's definitely been up and down, especially just like with this past year in the pandemic. I think that's shifting from recording live in the studio is very different, obviously, than like recording from our house. But overall, I think that we've learned a lot. I really enjoy producing, researching, recording all the shows. We were going to do an episode on mutual aid, which we unfortunately don't have time for, but I think that we've learned a lot about where to donate and how you can help out different alternative social justice causes. And yeah, it's just been a really great experience. And I've learned a lot just from producing these shows every week.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I've been working at CKUT/The McGill Daily since I was 19. And I remember going, you know, to the studio for the first time when I was in first year, and it was very intimidating. But now I'm sort of sad that we can't have our official send-off at the studio, because I think that would have been a lot more, it would have been more significant, I feel.
Legitimate, for sure. Yeah. I think that there's something special about going in the booth.
Yeah. And like, it feels a lot more like professional. I feel like a, you know, artsy little worker bee.
Yeah, I know. I feel like this is like we're recording for SoundCloud or something. But yeah, no, I do agree with you. I wish that we could have had a proper send off, but I think that we've done the most with what we can thus far. We're super thankful that like we've still been able to secure even this mic that we're recording on, like equipment to try and produce the best possible show that we can. And yeah, bittersweet, but I know that the show's in good hands.
Exactly. I was about to say, y'all are not going to be left with someone who does not understand the importance of, you know, genuine, transparent reporting. And yeah, we just wanted to kind of take this moment to say goodbye. And we've loved working at CKUT. We've loved being able to have this opportunity. Radio is sort of a, you know, a difficult thing to get into. So we're glad that we had the chance to have this show at 5 p.m. every Tuesday. And I'm definitely going to miss it, but I think it's time that I find my next passion. I find my next, you know, journey. But yeah, we just want to say thank you so much to everyone that has ever helped us, that has ever told us how to do anything. Specifically, a shout out to Spencer, the production person at CKUT. Without Spencer's help, I don't think our shows would have been nearly as good, especially, you know, because of remote recording.
We were audio quality.
Audio quality, editing, taught me how to use Adobe Audition.
Yeah.
So thank you so much, Spencer. Thank you to everyone that's ever listened. If we have any dedicated listeners,
like literally my family.
Shout out to Maya's family. Thank you for always tuning in.
And thank you so much to everybody who's ever helped us out in terms of interviewing, coming onto the show. Like, we're so happy to have such a diverse group of people talking about their expertise, and honestly, they're volunteering their time just to help us out and produce good episodes. And I'm just super grateful for everybody taking time out of their day to do some research and chat with us so that we could put it on TKUT.
And watch out for Pilar next year. She will be back in September as per usual. And I'm excited to see what she'll do. So thanks, guys. That was our weekly headline roundup. Also our, you know, last weekly headline roundup as a little duo.
So sad.
But it's now time for, of course, a quick Ruby tune and then our audio essay.
And I feel good as new. You're like a feather, the way you bruise. I'm still gonna wear these clothes when I'm 22. Pathetic rain, sheltered it with blood. I guess it's all down to that after school club. I don't know what it is I'm to do. That's the word up on the avenue. A policeman knocking down my door. Luckily for me, I was on tour. 1 million stories, 1 million poor pieces. Family adore me, I'm silly, I'm sorry. Confetti rains, sheltered it with hugs. I guess it's all down to that after school club. What's fun? That after school club. What's fun? What's fun? I don't know what it is I'm to do. Don't know what I got myself into. I just wanna see my health improve. As if I'm caught guilty for my crew. No point in telling the fucking truth. Confetti rains, blatant blaming thugs. I guess it's all down to that after school club. I guess it's all down to that after school club. What's fun? That after school club. What's fun? That after school club. What's fun? What's fun? That after school club. What's fun? What's fun? That after school club. And by the way, I'll cease to admit it. Cornered my pride and cease to re-give it. And even if I lie, I know I'll still be with it. It's not the rocks, not the trees, it's the deathbed of thieves that alone still breathe on the summer's 19. Proceed, I guess it's all down to the teachers I teach. No, 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 no. I guess it's all down to the after school club. Probably display the boundaries above. A whole parole or an amicable bunch. I guess it's all down to the after school club. I'm so involved and I can't give it up. What's fun, 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 that after school.
such a long time since I set foot in the club. I really hate this shit, don't I? I hate feeling rushed. Girl, can I just be honest? I don't feel like talking unless it's about me or philosophy. Can we just get down to business, and when we're both finished, then we'll have a reason to speak. Then you can open up to me. Girl, let me plant my seed. Girl, let me fill your needs. Girl, open up to me. Open up.
You want same one that on which I write these songs for you. I want in the same that goes for us too. I give you my name, the bed on which I lay to sleep and lay with you and lay in deep. There ain't no difference, this case there isn't. That goes for us too. I know you're listening.
Sometimes it feels like I don't really care. One day you'll see what in the meantime. Just trust that I'm there. Just trust that I love you. Just trust that I care. Trust that I need you to always be there. Trust that you know me well enough to know I'm the high priest, but you put on the show. Then you can open up to me. Girl, let me plant my seed. Girl, let me fill your need.
Welcome back to Unfit to Print. That was Cosmo Pike with After School Club, followed by Daniel Caesar with Open Up.
So now it's time for our audio essay on domestic abuse in the wake of the pandemic. This segment starts out by giving an overview on domestic and intimate partner violence, followed by specifics about the recent horrific femicides occurring and reported in Quebec. We also talked about gendered violence and its intersections, as well as how we can assist survivors outside of police aid. Again, we issued a content warning earlier as this segment discusses domestic abuse and death. We're going to play it now.
Before we begin our audio essay today, we wanted to quote a passage from the Women Against Abuse website. With a few revisions made, we feel that it is reflective of our own moral stance here on the show. Unfortunately, due to our time limit, we often condense our research so that you folks can have a summarized version of a big issue. In doing so, we may choose to focus on certain aspects of an issue and turn neglecting or leaving out other but equally important perspectives. To quote Women Against Abuse, we recognize that abuse occurs within a spectrum of relationships. Some of these relationships include sex trafficking, relationships described as hooking up, dating, friends with benefits, or other terminology, abuse within an institutional setting, and other abusive relationships, where there is a pattern of coercive behavior or tactics utilized against the survivor with the purpose of gaining and keeping power or control over them, unquote. We wanted to acknowledge the complexity of human relationships and, as a result, the complexity of abuse. We prioritize an intersectional approach to issues that we discuss on the show, but unfortunately, we cannot cover the myriad of ways one can be harmed in their relationships. Nonetheless, we stand with survivors of abuse. Ever since the early beginnings of the pandemic in March, experts have noted an increase of domestic violence incidents. Some have even begun to say the pandemic has spurred a new pandemic, one of intimate partner violence, otherwise known as IPV. Being cooped up at home for a year now, stressing about finances, small spaces, interpersonal relationships, and the pandemic itself creates the perfect breeding grounds for domestic violence, according to Marianne Hester, a sociologist at Bristol University. When speaking to the New York Times, Hester noted that domestic violence incidents usually go up when families spend extended amounts of time together, such as over the holidays. Not only has the pandemic created new tensions within home environments, it has also placed strain on previously abusive household relationships. With the closure of schools and childcare facilities, additional parental stress has been placed on households who may have to take care of their children full-time during the pandemic. This is without considering the burden of parental involvement and assistance with the child's virtual learning. Increased stress has been placed on physical family environments, leading to a rise in child abuse, according to the New England Journal of Medicine. Furthermore, without regular interventions of childcare workers, clinicians, and other professionals, domestic abuse situations are less likely to be reported by folks outside the home.
According again to the New England Journal of Medicine, 1 in 4 women and 1 in 10 men experience IPV. This violence has a disproportionate effect on people of color and other marginalized groups. However, it impacts folks of all races, religions, socioeconomic statuses, genders, and sexual orientations. The New England Journal of Medicine points to economic independence as being a crucial factor for escaping situations of domestic abuse. For many, a shared financial situation with an abusive partner does not allow for survivors to find other sources of economic support. We see here how, again, the pandemic creates unsafe conditions for survivors of domestic abuse. Increased job loss, financial strain, and unemployment has been experienced in the past year, especially for those without college degrees, women of color, and immigrants. Without a stable source of independent income, survivors feel less safe and less autonomous in their situations of abuse. As IPV springs up and pre-existing situations worsen, survivors find themselves without a place to escape. Many shelters have closed amidst the pandemic because the risk of infection remains too great. Though some restrictions have been lifted, many shelters are still operating at limited capacity. Fleeing to a friend or a family member's house also poses the risk of infection, and in Montreal, remains impossible after the 9:30 p.m. curfew. In some urban centers, alternatives have been set up to assist survivors of domestic abuse. In Chicago, Mayor Lori Lightfoot announced that the city was partnering with Airbnb in April 2020 to provide safe housing for survivors during the pandemic. Shelters have also made efforts to ease crowding by helping residents move into hotels or extended stay apartments. Prior to the pandemic, there have always been domestic abuse hotlines that are available 24/7 for survivors to seek help. We've included some of them on our show previously. When coronavirus pushed North America into a lockdown in March 2020, however, many domestic abuse hotlines readied themselves for increased calls. Surprisingly enough, many of these hotlines experienced the opposite. Some reported a 50% drop in reports of domestic violence. Experts knew, however, that the incidences of intimate partner or domestic violence had not dropped. Rather, survivors were unable to safely connect with outside support and assistance. As the lockdown conditions have bred an unsafe environment for abusive situations, surveillance of survivors within their homes have also increased. Unable to leave the house due to COVID, rising conflicts have increased chances to turn into abusive situation. The hotline situation, in particular, has brought long overdue attention to the inadequate protections set up for survivors of domestic abuse and IPV in urban and rural communities. The way in which police reports for domestic abuse can be filed varies. Some precincts offer online options, while others require in-person visits. Similarly, individual trial courts will vary in discretion when it comes to procedures for restraining orders. The lack of a coherent and consistent process for reporting abuse can be discouraging for people seeking help through the legal system. Black and brown POC may also be less likely than white people to involve the police when domestic abuse escalates for this reason.
Last week, a horrifying statistic about domestic abuse in Quebec was brought to our attention. Over the past 7 weeks, seven women had been murdered by their intimate partners in situations of domestic abuse in Quebec. The story is not being circulated nearly enough as it should be. Quebec is just one of many places where the pandemic has exacerbated pre-existing issues of inequitable social determinants of health. The lockdown has not been equivalently difficult for all, considering the troubling uptick in IPV and downtick in its situational reports. Here on Unfit, we feel it's necessary to report on the issue, as many other news outlets don't seem to be covering it in depth. In this segment, we'll be talking about the aforementioned Quebec femicides and Canadian statistics of domestic abuse. We'll then dive into gendered violence and its intersectionality and why the current justice and policing system is not sufficient when it comes to addressing the pandemic of domestic violence. An article published by Global News outlined the spike in incidents of violence against women in the past months. Over the course of 7 weeks, seven women were killed in Quebec. Quebec Deputy Premier Geneviève Gibault spoke at a conference in Quebec City, stating that, quote, "It's seven deaths too many, seven tragedies that as women, as a government, as a society, we cannot accept," unquote. Gibault also said that she, quote, "just wanted to be clear on this. At no time should a woman fleeing a violent family home with her children be worried about the police, by curfew rules, by sanitary rules, by police health," she said. "There are no restrictions that exist for a woman who must leave a violent environment," unquote. According to Global News, there has been a, quote, 45% increase in domestic charges being laid, stemming from a 12% increase in cases signaled to police, unquote. In Quebec, there are a total of 87 organizations which offer domestic abuse services. According to Domestic Shelters Org, 19 of these organizations have complete information regarding their services and programs on their websites. Within each program, there are categories which offer varying individual services. In Quebec, the most commonly used category is emergency services, and least used is housing services. Domestic Shelters Org offers a list on their website of Quebec cities which have domestic violence programs. In Canada, women are disproportionately affected by domestic violence, sexual assault and harassment, and sex trafficking. The Canadian Women's Foundation detailed why it's so important to speak to gender-based violence, quote, "because it costs women their lives. Approximately every 6 days, a woman in Canada is killed by her intimate partner. Violence against women costs taxpayers and the government billions of dollars every year. Canadians collectively spend $7.4 billion to deal with the aftermath of spousal violence alone. It has a profound effect on children. Children who witness violence in the home have twice the rate of psychiatric disorders as children from nonviolent homes," unquote.
According to Canadian Women's Foundation, quote, "half of all women in Canada have experienced at least one incident of physical or sexual violence since the age of 16. 67% of Canadians say they have personally known at least one woman who has experienced physical or sexual abuse. Approximately every 6 days, a woman in Canada is killed by her intimate partner. Out of the 83 police-reported intimate partner homicides that took place in 2014, 67 of those victims, over 80%, were women. On any given night in Canada, 3,491 women and their 2,724 children sleep in shelters because it isn't safe at home. On any given night, about 300 women and children are turned away because shelters are already full. There are 1,181 cases of missing and murdered Aboriginal women in Canada between 1980 and 2012, according to the RCMP. However, according to grassroots organization and the Minister of the Status of Women, the number is much closer to 4,000. Indigenous women are killed at 6 times the rate of non-Indigenous women. Women are at greater risk of experiencing elder abuse from a family member, accounting for 60% of senior survivors of family violence," unquote. It is important to look at who is most at risk of gender-based violence. On our March 16th episode, we spoke about the Canadian government and the Quebec government's failures in protecting missing and murdered Indigenous women. Also, in general, failing to enact any change, both legislatively and tangible change seen within systems and seen within communities. According to the Canadian Women's Foundation, quote, Aboriginal women, First Nation, Inuit, and Métis are 2.5 times more likely to be victims of violence than non-Aboriginal women, unquote. Further, women with disabilities and neurodivergent women are 2 to 3 times more likely to experience violence than non-disabled women and women that and neurotypical women. The Canadian Women's Foundation stated that, quote, 60% of women with a disability experience some form of violence, unquote. The justice system specifically fails women of color. When women of color report incidents of violence, quote, their experiences are often taken less seriously within the criminal justice system and their perpetrators routinely receive less harsh punishments, unquote. Domestic violence largely affects children as well. The Canadian Women's Foundation outlines how children who witness or experience domestic violence are much more likely to struggle with their mental health. In Canada, roughly 362,000 children are exposed to family violence each year.
We now want to turn our focus on to the intersections of domestic violence and intimate partner violence. Although all kinds of people experience forms of abuse, domestic violence often targets women. In 2016, Women's Aid Members Area published a report stating that, quote, women are far more likely than men to be killed by partners slash ex-partners. In 2013/2014, this was 46% of female homicide victims killed by a partner or ex-partner, compared with 7% of male victims. Furthermore, in the three-year period starting in 2011, finishing in 2014, all but one of the women killed by their partner or ex-partner were killed by a male suspect. Around a third of male victims killed by their partner or ex-partner were killed by a male suspect, and most of these were perpetrated by a male emotional rival. For example, the husband of the male victim's lover, unquote. Unfortunately, the mainstream discourse surrounding domestic violence frequently dismisses the realities of queer folks and communities. In queer relationships, there are intersections to the violence experienced. As stated by the New York State Government website, from their Office for the Prevention of Domestic Violence, quote, domestic slash intimate partner violence tactics in LGBTQ relationships are similar to those used in heterosexual relationships, but also include the use of anti-LGBTQ societal stigma and bias as a central tactic to exert power and control and increase isolation, unquote. This isolation is a significant factor that contributes to the cycle of abuse. Moreover, quote, inequalities other than gender, such as income or education, unquote, can impact a survivor's experiences with abuse. It is necessary that we include and consider the tactics of heterosexism and homophobia when discussing the ways in which perpetrators of violence can harm their partners. While looking at these intersections, we consider the role racism plays in the targeting of survivors when it comes to intimate partner abuse and domestic violence. As discussed in last week's editorial, titled "The Atlanta Shootings Are a Result of Anti-Asian Racism and Misogyny," published in the McGill Daily, the shootings were a result of racism and sexism, attacking these women specifically because they were racialized people and suspected to be sex workers. This terrorist act revealed the violent attitudes towards and treatment of migrant sex workers, and how legislature does not properly protect them while working. Before we continue, I would like to quote the McGill Daily regarding the word Asian. The Daily uses the term Asian in this editorial in accordance with the dominant conversations happening around the shootings in massage parlors in the Atlanta area and the rise in anti-Asian violence throughout the COVID-19 pandemic. We recognize as an editorial board that these specific acts of violence are mainly perpetrated against East Asian communities and that Asia is not a monolith. People across the continent are racialized in different ways that cannot be fully encompassed under the word Asian, unquote. As stated by Karen Wang in Battered Asian American Woman, Community Responses from the Battered Women's Movement and the Asian American Community, quote, Asian American women are still relatively unheard and unknown. While the movement against domestic violence has made tremendous gains in the past 20 years, not all battered women have benefited equally. Women of color have gained less from the progress of the anti-domestic violence movement, which has been primarily white-centered. And within communities of color, including Asian American communities, domestic violence has yet to become a priority issue, unquote.
Wang goes on to explain that, quote, although battered women experience universally similar abuse, the needs and concerns of Asian American domestic violence victims require special attention. Battered Asian American women are situated differently than other battered women in the United States, especially white women. Domestic violence is a complex psychological and sociological phenomenon which is further complicated in Asian American communities by other factors such as language, immigrant status, culture, and racial stereotypes. Battered Asian American women stand at the intersection of multiple identities, not only as women and domestic violence victims, but also as Asians and often as immigrants. However, American society and laws, which are constructed largely along binary lines, example, the black-white paradigm of race, have great difficulty recognizing intersectionalities and effectively ignore those, such as battered Asian American women, who exist at intersections of identity, unquote. Wang emphasizes the need for an intersectional framework between the Asian American community and domestic violence experienced by Asian women. Once again, there needs to be a greater consideration and inclusion of these intersecting identities, such as race, specifically in the context of anti-Asian racism and misogyny. As mentioned earlier, factors such as socioeconomic status play a significant role in domestic abuse. According to Jill Josephon, quote, "The U.S. social welfare system has a long history of engaging in gendered and racialized social control of service recipients," unquote. Josephine explains that there are intersections between the welfare system and domestic abuse, and how America's class system keeps individuals isolated from resources. What we just covered, obviously, is a brief summary of complex and important aspects of abuse and how survivors can be trapped in abusive situations. We wanted to cover these aspects because, like we said earlier, oftentimes abuse is discussed in a way that erases necessary details that better explain the cycle of abuse, such as racism, class, and sexuality. Without this context, we easily assume that all survivors and their lived experiences share commonalities. This is not always the case. All survivors are valid in their experiences, but oftentimes they also differ. We need to open up the mainstream conversation regarding abuse in order to create better protection for survivors. An important step in becoming better when talking about abuse is making sure the language is considerate and respectful. We will include a resource from Tool explaining the preferred language when discussing people who have experienced violence, as well as definitions of types of abuse. We've discussed how institutional colonialism, racism, sexism, and homophobia influence the way domestic violence is discussed, experienced, and understood. However, we have yet to address whether or not institutions themselves confront and prosecute domestic violence.
According to an article by HealthTalk.org, the police and their, quote, key frontline services, unquote, are critical for the prevention and the stopping of incidents of abuse. While police are the main option of immediate protection for many people experiencing abuse, the police system does not provide proper support, protection, or understanding for people experiencing abuse. In 2015, the crime of coercive control was introduced, which acknowledges that, quote, domestic violence, rather than being a series of incidents, is a matter of controlling behaviors, unquote. There has been criticism of police response to incidents of domestic abuse and regarding the coercive control law. Action by police has yet to be seen. According to HealthTalk.org, quote, "While some women found the police helpful, others felt officers did not understand or take them seriously. Women were desperate for an immediate response and found it hard to manage the delays in the process of getting a court injunction or having their injuries assessed," unquote. HealthTalk spoke to a woman named Yasmin, who called the police from her children's school. The police officer then came to her house to assess the situation and insisted that she leave with her. Yasmin stated, quote, "I can't leave my house without my children," unquote, but had to trust the police officer would eventually bring her children to her. From the police, there was no assurance that her children would be brought safely to her. According to HealthTalk.org, the majority of women who contact the police feel, quote, "police officers' understanding of domestic violence and abuse was poor, limited to an emphasis on physical abuse and a need for hard evidence, which was usually difficult to establish," unquote. Women who spoke to HealthTalk.org said the police suggested keeping a diary to log their abusers' repeated behaviors, and yet most women claim that police only take cases with hard evidence seriously. Institutionally, the police do not work on the side of the survivor. There is also a lack of sympathy within the police system for survivors. A woman named Penny, who was being stalked and harassed by her ex-partner, explained how the police responded to her emotional statements, quote, "as if it were insignificant," unquote. Again, according to HealthTalk.org, quote, many women lived in fear of a partner who made serious threats to harm them and the children, backed up by previous assaults that had left no visible evidence or that women had been too fearful to report, unquote. Continuously, the police system fails survivors not taking their case seriously, quote, unless they were at the point of about to be murdered, unquote. The Bureau of Investigative Journalism spoke to a woman named Debbie. Debbie's partner was a police officer in the same force which she wanted to call. Debbie stated that, quote, he used to say the police would protect him if I phoned up against him, he would just put me in prison, unquote. According to the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, many women experience abuse from their partners who are police officers, using their positions to, quote, seek to intimidate or harass them, unquote. A study done in the UK showed that in England, only 3.9% of abuse allegations against police officers end up in a conviction. Not only does the police system work against survivors, but it protects police abusers. We will now be discussing solutions to the police and the need for legal reform and increased funding.
Doing research for this segment, we found multiple expert opinions on what the next steps should be to help stop domestic violence. First and foremost is to get to the root of the problem, that is, to stop people from becoming abusers in the first place. Broad cultural messages and programs that show and teach mutual respect between genders, plus discuss ways in which you can channel your emotions in a healthy way, have proven to be effective. The ideal targets for these programs would be those kids who have lived in abusive homes, as they're at the most risk of becoming abusers later on in life. These programs, once scaled up, should be studied longitudinally in order to understand the impacts of prevention opposed to intervention on the domestic abuse pandemic. Next, coherence must be followed across the so-called justice system in order to bring proper punishment to abusers. Penalties for domestic violence must stay consistent and firm, meaning that reports of domestic abuse situations should be consistent and accessible, and filing in independent courts for restraining orders should not be largely subjective when it comes to situations of domestic abuse. In the past, it has been customary to offer first-time abuse offenders the opportunity to choose a counseling program opposed to doing time in prison. These programs report around a 23% success rate over 12 to 18 months, according to the New Republic. Because the success rate is still quite low, harsh penalties must be implemented in our justice system for abusers. Swift and serious sentencing without subjectivity, considering professional athletes skipping out on punishment, for example, is crucial to decrease incidents of domestic abuse. When it comes to publicized figures who are accused of domestic violence, their parent organization, again such as the NFL for a football player, must severely punish the abuser as well in order to send messages to abusers everywhere. This could look like a ban from the league in the case of the NFL player. Punishment must also be implemented culturally, not just judicially, in order to prove the serious consequences of domestic violence. Increasing funding for support services is ultimately crucial. As mentioned before, financial independence remains to be an important factor in escaping situations of domestic abuse. Not only is it difficult if your finances are tied up with your abusers, but finding a safe place to go in order to leave a physical environment of abuse requires monetary resources. On a communal level, shelters and organizations need funding in order to keep safe spaces and transitional houses open, provide helplines and rehabilitation systems to survivors as well. Furthermore, medical professionals can identify survivors in healthcare settings and provide counseling and connect people with social services, as medical offices can be places for patients to disclose abuse. Support services and funding towards public health can ultimately help survivors not only report their situations, but recover from violent instances.
These are just three larger movements towards ending the pandemic of domestic abuse. Of course, there are smaller, everyday changes we need to make in regards to recognizing and reporting these situations. Watch out for telltale signs amongst your loved ones, and consider how the police may not always be the best place to call in times of crisis. However, cultural prevention, consistent and harsh judicial punishments, and increased funding for support systems are all necessary and expert-recommended changes that need to be made in order to stop this systemic issue.
It is evident from our research that domestic abuse is a complicated and harmful reality that impacts the lives of many. The pandemic has placed those experiencing violence at home in a greater position of vulnerability. It is necessary to look at abuse from all angles and how systemic issues intersect with this violence. Although this is our last show for the semester, we plan to keep reporting on this violence in the fall with follow-up segments. We need more systems of care and protection that work with survivors of domestic violence in order for justice to be properly served. That is all we have today, folks. We will now read out our last resource list of the semester.
Okay, so first up on our resource list, we have a GoFundMe called We to People Community Love. From the website, it says, quote, "This summer we plan on traveling across the country to host summer programs for the youth, teaching them how to be activists, leaders, CEOs, while also teaching them what does it mean to be a person of color. We also are hosting seminars for high school students and upwards. We will be giving educational and job resources, all while teaching them to be self-reliant. With police stop training and a more in-depth session of the summer programs, we're raising money to cover our 501c3 fees, travel fees, car rental, hotel fees, venue fees, food while traveling, and all tools we're providing for each summer program, including any extra fees." So that is a really good resource. And if you have any extra funds and feel like donating to a cause for children of color, that's a really great place to donate to.
Next up, we have Women Against Abuse, Test Your Knowledge educational resource. This resource obviously is an educational one, and it sort of helps you understand the vignettes of abuse scenarios in which you can test yourself on to see whether you can distinguish between physical, emotional, sexual, financial, and abuse through technology. So that, I think, is just a way to, you know, be able to spot and point out moments of abuse both for yourself and for those in your direct community.
Next up, we have a GoFundMe for the Native Women's Association of Canada. So this is a GoFundMe that was started by two students from UVic. To quote the GoFundMe page, quote, "This organization engages in policy-based advocacy to address violence against women," unquote. You can also donate to the NWAC directly through their website.
Next up, we have the Native Women's Association of Canada website. This website has some really great resources and outreach opportunities. For example, they have a program called Indigenous Skills and Employment Training, which, to quote the website, helps Indigenous women and gender diverse individuals to fully participate in economic opportunities, unquote.
And last up, we just have a list from partnersforprevention.org. It's a preferred terminology list, which is just talking about considerate and respectful terminology when discussing domestic abuse. We definitely consulted it for writing this audio essay, and you should look at it too.
All right, folks, that's all we have for today. Thank you for tuning in to our last show of the semester. We'll see you. Well, we won't see you, but Pilar will see you in the fall. Welcome back to Unfit to Print. You're listening to CKUT on 90.3 FM. That was our audio essay on domestic and gendered violence in the face of the pandemic. Make sure to check out our resources included at the end so you can better recognize instances of domestic violence when you see it. Mutual Aid is such a key resource in individual cases of domestic violence, so if you have any funds to spare, we encourage you to seek out survivors' GoFundMes or donation sites to help them leave harmful situations.
Thanks for tuning in this week for Unfit. Much appreciated. And thank you so much to everybody who has tuned in general over the past years. Amy and I have worked really hard every week to produce quality content for our listeners, and we really hoped it was as fun to listen to as it was to produce. We will be handing over the radio reins, but that doesn't mean Unfit is going anywhere. The show will air next September with a new host, the lovely Pilar, but again, the same content and issues we like to analyze on the show will still be present. Thanks once again for tuning in, everybody. Much appreciated. Playing us out, we have Crumb with Plants, followed by Winona Forever with Gazing.
I have class, got a lot of time on my hands. The global outbreak of COVID-19 has affected all our lives in various ways, and it has notably drawn our attention to the intensified systemic racism and selective xenophobia towards our racialized friends in our Canadian society. It is understandable for each of us to feel anxious about this fatal disease. However, the sentiment of fear does not give us the right or the opportunity to conduct hate crime and to discriminate against our Asians, Blacks, Indigenous, and other racialized friends. It is not okay to associate the COVID-19 disease with Asians, particularly those of Chinese descent. It is not okay to conduct physical and psychological abuses towards racialized individuals. It is not okay to vandalize Asians and other marginalized owned businesses. We must stop normalizing and stop accepting racist conducts and hate speeches towards all racialized communities. Rather, in these unprecedented times of global pandemic, together, we must educate ourselves and others and be eager to understand race, systemic racism, and racial justice in Canada and elsewhere. Remember, whoever, wherever, and whenever we are humankind. We must learn to stand together as citizens of the world for a healthier, safer, and happier community.